is the October 1999 issue of Street Spirit, and it's an article by Chris Crass, who's been serving with Food Not Bombs for at least half a decade. And Food Not Bombs, they actually laid off Food Not Bombs. The San Francisco police, after making more than 1,000 arrests in a period of 6 years, about the time I went to jail in San Francisco for serving free food, actually for violating a court order against serving free food, and I violated the order in 93, I was convicted in 94, my appeal fell through in 96, and I was sent off to jail in the summer of 96. That was the last arrest made of a Food Not Bombs meal or citation was around the time I went to jail, when the Food Not Bombs began serving breakfast regularly on the steps of the jail to protest my jailing. And I think under Mayor Brown, he decided he'd rather go after homeless people who are sleeping than Food Not Bombs. And now apparently he's changed his mind. He's turning after Food Not Bombs as well. And that's what this article is about, and I'm going to read it to you. San Francisco Food Not Bombs has a long history of harassment and repression on the part of City Hall and the police. Over the past 10 years, we've been arrested hundreds of times, our food confiscated as evidence or dumped into the gutter. Police have made threats to our members and our literature about economic inequality. Our literature about economic inequality and local protests has been seized along with our banners and signs. We were arrested in Golden Gate Park and in Civic Center under the Agnos administration and arrested in Civic Center and United Nations Plaza under the Jordan administration. So when police approached us twice this past month to inform us that we were in violation of the law and that we must cease sharing free food in United Nations Plaza, many said, oh no, not again. When Willie Brown ran for mayor in 1995, along with all the other candidates running against Frank Jordan, he stated in the Bay Guardian that he opposed Jordan's policies on homelessness and declared that he was against the police arresting Food Not Bombs. Brown pledged to dismantle the infamous Matrix program, which criminalized homeless people for, quote, quality of life infractions. Additionally, Terrence Hallinan, who was then running for district attorney, repeatedly stated that he opposed the repression against Food Not Bombs and that once elected, he would not prosecute anyone for serving free food with Food Not Bombs. Many people believed that the times of police arresting or harassing people for sharing food were over. Now, however, the mayoral election quickly approaches and all bets are off. Criminalizing Food Not Bombs' First Amendment activities is a reiteration of the same weary scene that has played out in Act 4 of the last three mayoral administrations. From a script that traditionally includes 3 years of do-nothing homeless policies, said Chance Martin of the Coalition on Homelessness. Martin added, as the scene unfolds, Food Not Bombs' food servings are suddenly portrayed by the city as a health risk. The real agenda here is that Food Not Bombs is regarded by quality of life proponents as a magnet for visible homelessness, as if providing vital nourishment to destitute human beings somehow creates poverty and hunger. The Coalition on Homelessness is currently organizing a rally for October 2nd, it actually did organize that rally, to kick off a national civil rights organizing project. On September 3rd and September 12th, Food Not Bombs activists were told that our community meal was in violation of the law and that we faced citations unless we packed up and left. On September 3rd, police gave two Food Not Bombers citations for, quote, selling food without a permit, regardless of the fact that we distribute food for free. On September 12th, three officers rolled up on Food Not Bombs and told us we must stop serving. The officer in charge said that the health department would be coming to UN Plaza and issuing citations for serving without a permit that neither the health department nor the city currently issue. The health department official called by the police reportedly said, I don't want to come down there and get involved. Strong support for Food Not Bombs from people eating at UN Plaza was expressed to the police. When the police approached the Food Not Bombs server to get ID, two men waiting in line for soup immediately volunteered to serve the food in a show of solidarity. The officer declined to take the IDs. The recent harassment of Food Not Bombs is part of a larger plan to eliminate homeless and low-income people from Civic Center and United Nations Plaza. The Board of Supervisors recently voted to make UN Plaza an official park of the city, falling under the jurisdiction of the Department of Parks and Recreation. Park and Rec has begun posting new regulations in UN Plaza that prohibit homeless people from being in the area from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. Sounds like the Jim Lang approach. That's what we have down here. Jim Lang is head of our own Santa Cruz Parks and Rec. Going back to Chris Crass's article. Using the police to force homeless people out of visible areas has long been a tactic used by elected officials, especially when they are up for re-election. In response to this tactic, Claire Bayard, Food Not Bombs organizer, said San Francisco is just trying to maintain its national reputation as one of the nastiest cities toward homeless folks. As elections approach, the police have stepped up their harassment of the homeless and their advocates in a sadly ironic attempt to remove from visibility everyone who is obviously suffering under the system and anyone who supports their civil and economic rights. There's no interest in fixing the real problems, Bayard charged, just in creating the appearance that the city has actually done something about the 14,000 people with nowhere else to go besides public spaces. The city has no empathy, and we, Food Not Bombs, have no tolerance for that. In addition to Food Not Bombs' recent visits from the police, a free lunch program organized by a group of students from Marin's Branson High School was ordered to cease their efforts to eliminate hunger in San Francisco. On September 11th, the students went to Civic Center to hand out sack lunches, as they have for over 5 years. The students were threatened with arrest by the group of police, who arrived in several police cars and a van. The students were literally chased out of the city's Civic Center for acting on their civic duty to help other citizens. The crackdown on the students generated front-page stories in the Examiner and the Chronicle, which then led to a compromise deal from the city. If you move to Bodecker Park in the heart of the Tenderloin, the police will not arrest you, the students were told by City Hall. Somehow, food was distributed in a less visible park hidden among the poverty of the Tenderloin is safer and does not pose a health risk, whereas the same food served under the same conditions in Civic Center poses a grave risk to the health of homeless people. Moreover, while free food programs like the ones organized by the Marin students and Food Not Bombs are heavily scrutinized by the city for supposed health and safety concerns, poor people eating out of trash cans and or dying on the street due to exposure seem to go unnoticed. Sister Bernie Galvin, founder and director of Religious Witness with Homeless People, has been organizing for years to make City Hall notice the inhumanity and injustice of poverty in San Francisco. Galvin and Religious Witness have organized countless protests, vigils, and acts of nonviolent civil disobedience to win affordable housing for low-income and no-income people and families. Galvin recently stated, "I have joined Food Not Bombs in serving those meals in UN Plaza, and I will continue to do so. This act of compassion for helping poor and hungry people is done in a reverent, respectful, warm, and gracious manner. Furthermore, if Mayor Brown does not back down from his threat to stop Food Not Bombs, I will organize the support of religious leaders to protect the right and responsibility of Food Not Bombs and all people of faith to follow the mandate of all faith traditions to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, shelter the homeless." Food Not Bombs activists hope to generate an enormous outpouring of support and solidarity from the larger social justice movement and concerned citizens from around the world. Already, emails of support have been sent to Mayor Willie Brown and the Board of Supervisors from many activists from as far away as Toronto, Canada, and Sydney, Australia. Food Not Bombs is working to build community and political support now so as to avoid further harassment and repression from the city. Food Not Bombs hopes that this support and solidarity will demonstrate a widely felt commitment to address the real causes of poverty and homelessness rather than policies which punish and persecute the poor. And that's an article by Chris Crass in the current issue of Street Spirit, which is a homeless newspaper sold on the streets of Santa Cruz. And there actually is an update to that story, which I'm going to try to read, but my printer, as I mentioned earlier, was going out. It's from Lennox Sweeney of San Jose Food Not Bombs, and he talks about, on Saturday, October 2nd, the Coalition on Homelessness held a rally at Civic Center marking the beginning of a national civil rights campaign. As they handed out free sack lunches to those in attendance, the San Francisco Police Department informed them that if they continued to serve food without a permit, the permit for the rally would be revoked. As the rally wound down, Food Not Bombs began serving dinner in adjacent United Nations Plaza. Minutes after the server set up, the San Francisco police force approached and threatened arrest if they did not cease sharing food without a permit. The officers radioed for backup when Food Not Bombs refused to stop serving, answering questions about the need for arrest only with a repetitive, "because it's illegal." In response to the police presence, 30 people, now it's becoming a little hard to read here, apparently 30 people came out and walked over to surround the food table. The police continued to watch but didn't do anything further. Continued harassment by the police of Food Not Bombs and other groups trying to share food in public spaces is unacceptable, and so forth. So they, even after that article that you just heard, the long article by Chris Crass, apparently police moved in to continue their high-profile serve a bagel, go to jail approach, which shows you at its most naked, bald, and blatant just how far police are willing to go, just how shameless they are. I don't know if we're going to say the police. I think that the police have a lot to do with this. I think that it may well be they may have gotten the Brown administration in San Francisco to take their gloves off so they can proceed. But I suspect a lot of impetus from this comes from the police themselves. Again, I'm not sure. This is just speculation. I've had my own experiences with them. I've been arrested probably half a dozen to a dozen times in San Francisco for serving free food, and as I've mentioned, I spent 4 weeks in jail for it after a jury trial, of all things. Of course, the person who defended me, the appointed defense attorney, had never done a political case, was a former district attorney, prosecutor, and hadn't done a jury trial in years, so I didn't have the best defense. But, you know, I'm hoping that the jury trials coming up for Nassim Zarifi, Vince Lombardo, Jim Costner, and Kuo-Ling Liao are more successful in terms of justice, and I'm talking about acquittals, because that's what I think justice would amount to in these matters. But if not acquittals, at least some jurors standing firm for not guilty. To acquit, you need 12 votes that say not guilty. But to stop a guilty verdict, all you need is one vote that says 1 out of 12, not guilty. And that brings us to the subject of jury nullification. And we're going to get to that subject after yet another musical interlude.
Light, did he die? Light one candle for the pain and joy. When
the light go out. Peter, Paul, and Mary, No Easy Road to Freedom. And the road to freedom requires, as conservatives are always eager to tell us, responsibility as well. And one of those responsibilities may be serving on a jury. Everybody gets annoyed when they get their jury summons. You know, you got to go to the court and you got to sit in these hot buildings and wait around day after day, losing money from a job that, you know, you have to work at, you may not like anyway, in order to pay rent, the usurious rents that we have here in Santa Cruz that go up and up and up. And why, you know, serve at some preposterously low rate on a jury? Well, because the judges and the prosecutors are doing bad things, and the legislators. I mean, the most obvious indication of this is the drug war, the drug prohibition, the prohibition against marijuana that is used to fund police departments, that is used to fund wars abroad, although heroin, I guess, is more, and crack are used more for that purpose, to destroy political dissent. It's used to elect conservatives to office. It's become a kind of a, it destroys countless families across the country. I mean, the figures on just marijuana prosecutions alone, locally, there's a majority of people in jail for drug-related offenses, so-called drug-related offenses. And though some of this may be appropriate incarceration of people who are drunk driving, where that's inexcusable, the harassment of people for distributing, possessing, selling, or using drugs is ridiculous. We saw that during the alcohol prohibition, where alcohol, probably the most dangerous drug next to nicotine, it just didn't pay to prohibit it. The cost was too great. That's not the way to proceed. And it's still a massive problem, there's no question about it, but it would be an even more massive problem if it were prohibited. And that just doesn't seem to get through to our legislators, and it certainly doesn't get through to our judges, and it doesn't get through to our DAs and our prosecutors. The people that it has to get through to are you and your fellow community members who are on juries. You are the people who ultimately deal out the justice. Now, it's true that most of these cases don't ever get to juries because people are afraid they're going to get convicted. They're afraid they're going to have to spend their life savings defending themselves. They're afraid they'll get a stiffer sentence after they're convicted than if they did a plea bargain beforehand. But the truth is that juries, historically, and I've only become aware of this in the last, well, I became aware of it about a decade ago when I started reading Fully Informed Jury Association literature from a group called FIJA, Fully Informed Jury Association. But more recently, I've been reading the writings of a man named Godfrey Lehman, who's a writer from San Francisco, has written a number of books on the issue of the history of juries. And juries have done some remarkable things, and that's what I'm going to read you about today. I'm going to read you about the trial of Susan B. Anthony from a book called The Political History of Jury Nullification by Godfrey Lehman. Susan B. Anthony, you should know, of course, was the feminist activist suffragette from the mid-19th century, who has also fought for the abolition of slavery, along with Frederick Douglass and Thaddeus Stevens and others. She also, of course, is a famous seminal figure in the history of rights of women. And she wanted to get the right of women to vote. Though now it seems we have nothing to vote for anyway, is one of the problems. You vote for them and they all vote the same. But the right of women to vote is a no-brainer. But in those days, people weren't using that part of their brains. And so what Susan B. Anthony did was, and we're going to read about this, she used the new 14th Amendment as a basis for going to vote because it didn't exclude women. And let's hear what Godfrey Lehman writes about this. In the presidential election of 1872, Susan B. Anthony did a daring thing. She went to the polling booths in Rochester, New York, and demanded that she be allowed to exercise her constitutional right to vote. She cited the recently adopted 14th and 15th Amendments as authority, even if there were no other. The 14th read that all persons born and naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and cannot be denied life, liberty, or the protection or property without due process of law, nor of the equal protection of the laws. The 15th Amendment, she pointed out, mandated that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. She was born in the United States, therefore a citizen, and thus could not be denied the right to vote. She didn't have fancy statutes in her hands. All she had was the Constitution, and she walked into the voting booth and said, "Let me vote." This is at a time when women were barred from voting. The male election officials considered these and agreed with her. She voted. Whereupon there was created a maelstrom within the chauvinistic judiciary reaching apoplectic fever. She was charged with the crime of voting and brought before a jury the following June. Her defense attorney, who was a judge himself, attempted to present to the jury the proposition that they had the right to find a general verdict, which meant to consider any statute of New York intending to deny women the right to vote and to weigh this against the 14th and 15th Amendments. That is to say, and this is the key argument about jury nullification, this is my addition to this story, the jury has the right to weigh the laws as well as to weigh the facts. The judge doesn't just say to them, okay, the New York law says women can't vote. You have to follow that law. No, they could weigh whether the 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution, newly passed, gave, in fact, Susan B. Anthony the right to vote, no matter what the New York law said. But presiding Judge Ward Hunt, who was also a justice of the United States Supreme Court at the time, was fearful of the possibilities of one or more honest jurymen. For indeed all 12 were men. To stifle them, he picked up the axe wielded by Judges Starling, Jeffries, Scroggs, and Chase, and swung it as even they had never dared. The question, gentlemen of the jury, in the form it finally takes is wholly a question of law in the first place, that under the 14th Amendment, which Miss Anthony claims protects her, she was not protected in the right to vote. And I have decided also that her belief in the advice which she took does not protect her in the act which she committed. If I am right in this, the result must be a verdict on your part of guilty, and I therefore direct that you find a verdict of guilty. The entire courtroom gasped, and the defense attorney, Judge Selden, objected. That is a direction no court has the power to make in a criminal issue. Presiding Judge Hunt would not listen. He turned to the clerk. Take the verdict, Mr. Clerk. This servile toady responded by addressing the jurymen, "Hearken to your verdict as the court has recorded it. You say you find the defendant guilty of the offense whereof she stands indicted, and so say you all." Defense Attorney Selden then asked for the jury to be polled. Judge Hunt shouted, "No, gentlemen of the jury, you are discharged." So I interrupt this story about Susan B. Anthony's trial to again emphasize this. The jury wasn't given a chance to deliberate. They weren't given a chance to even say what their verdict was. The judge decided what the verdict was. Normally, the judge will say to the jury, "You have to only consider the law as I give it to you. And did she cast that ballot? If she did, then I say she's guilty because the law says that you can't vote in New York in 1872. And the jury, you would have to agree with me because I judge the law and you only will judge whether, in fact, she actually cast a vote." But in this case, the judge was so outrageous to say, "I'm not even going to let you vote and say anything at all about this other than I will direct what your verdict is, guilty." Continuing. The jury was nonetheless unofficially polled after their discharge, and those responding to the poll indicated they would have acquitted her. Had this happened, the whole cause of women's rights would have been advanced by almost half a century, because women didn't get the right to vote until about 1918, 1919, when the... Was it the 18th Amendment? In any case, an amendment about that time passed allowing for the right of women to vote specifically. The right of women to vote would have been recognized with as effectual a force as the right of black persons to be free was recognized by juries in Massachusetts 90 years before, and that's another issue I'm going to read about soon. The 19th Amendment, as we know it, probably would have been unnecessary. That's the amendment allowing women to vote. A second trial was held the same afternoon before the same judge, the defendants being the three election officials who had allowed Miss Anthony to vote. Judge Hunt again declared there was nothing to go to the jury, but the defense attorney, John Van Voorhees, argued that the jury must pass upon this whole case. Hunt overruled him, and Van Voorhees asked that he be permitted to address the jury. Hunt shouted, "I don't think there is anything upon which you can legitimately address the jury." These jurymen had all been in attendance in the morning session, and he told them now that, "I decided in the case of Miss Anthony, which many of you heard probably, that under the law as it stands, the ladies who offered their votes had no rights whatever. I repeat that decision, and I charge you that the inspectors of the election ought not to receive them." Feeling more secure with this jury, Hunt made one concession. "Instead of doing as I did in the case this morning, directing a verdict, I submit the case to you with these instructions, and you can decide it here, or you may go out." Van Voorhees swung valiantly. "I ask your honor to instruct the jury that if they find these inspectors acted honestly, to in accordance with their best judgment, they should be acquitted." The judge said, "I have expressly ruled to the contrary of that, gentlemen, that that make no difference." Van Voorhees would not yield. "There was no conclusive evidence that the ladies voted at all," he suggested, "because ballots were cast in secret, and thus no one could know if any name was written thereon." "I charge the jury that there is sufficient evidence to sustain the indictment," said the judge. "But there is sufficient evidence to sustain a verdict of not guilty," said Voorhees. "I cannot charge that." Voorhees asked that if the jury returned not guilty, could Judge Hunt set the verdict aside? Hunt would not answer, but told the jury that they could deliberate here or retire. The jury retired. Several hours later, they returned undecided, split 11-1. Hunt told them that the court would adjourn until the following morning without indicating what would happen overnight to the jury. The question became moot, for the 11 apparently exerted such pressure upon the 1 that he capitulated, and in 10 minutes they were back, guilty. But defense attorneys Selden and Van Voorhees asked for new trials, both of them. They were denied. Miss Anthony was fined $100, but she never paid it. The inspectors were fined $25 each and the costs of the prosecution. Had the second trial been conducted in a free atmosphere, it is quite possible the jury would have acquitted also, or at least been hung. Although controlling the selection of jurors was not apparently the principal issue in the calamity of the Anthony trials, it was and continues to be a prominent influence in jury management. Among the reasons why it is possible to control selection is the apathy of citizens generally. Either we permit the corruption, or we try to dodge jury service, grateful for any action by the courts to excuse us from the burden. So, that's something I was never aware of. You've been listening to a chapter in the book, The Political History of Jury Nullification, about the case of Susan B. Anthony, who voted based on the authority of the 14th and 15th Amendments to vote, that everybody in the United States, born in the United States, or naturalized here, was a citizen, and that citizens have the right to vote. They didn't talk about women one way or the other, but she voted, the election officials said, let her vote, and the judge, a Supreme Court justice who decided he didn't want women to vote, took the case to trial and refused to even let the jury talk about the issue, just directing them to say guilty. Interesting stuff. Another interesting reference you may have heard here was the question of slavery. And again, this was something that I had never been aware of. It's something that happened in Massachusetts. And I'm taking a quick look here. I want to find the proper page. And the jury abolishes slavery. In March of 1765, Jenny Slew came before the Inferior Court of Common Pleas in Massachusetts Colony to plead for her freedom from slavery. As a mulatto, having had a white mother, she believed she was entitled to liberty. The judges refused to confront the dilemma and dismissed her appeal arbitrarily. The following year, she did a smarter thing. She filed a civil suit against her master, Gentleman John Whipple, Jr. of Ipswich, asking for a jury trial. The jury did not take long to decide. They directed Whipple to pay her £4 damages and all costs, implying thereby that Jenny was a free woman, because you cannot give such a ruling to a slave. Between that year and 1783, some 15 or 20 black slaves made appeals to Massachusetts civil juries. Now, the difference between a civil jury and a criminal jury, for those who don't know, criminal juries decide when crimes are charged against you. Civil juries decide when one person sues another for monetary damages or to get some kind of relief. And so slaves were suing their owners saying, I want damages because you've held me in slavery. And they were getting them from Massachusetts juries. Continuing to read. In all but one of these 15 to 20 instances, an aging slave purchased 40 years before and likely to become a public charge was the one exception, the jurors granted the appeals, flying directly in the face of long-established custom because they believed that they in Africa had as much right to enslave us, meaning nobody has a right to enslave anybody. They directed the white masters to pay damages of varying amounts. The final case was a criminal charge brought by the Commonwealth in 1783, that's again after the American Revolution but before the Constitution was adopted, during the period of time called the Confederation, not to be confused with the Southern Confederacy. The Confederation was the form of government the U.S. had, the 13 colonies, or former colonies, had before they adopted the U.S. Constitution's Federation. It was a weaker form of government. Massachusetts' new state constitution contained the provision that all men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among them being their lives and liberties. This final case was a criminal charge brought by the Commonwealth in 1783 against a white master who had already been assessed damages by two civil juries. Court and Commonwealth asked the jurors to answer directly the question, does this clause cover blacks as well as whites? The jurors delivered their interpretation. Yes, it does. They convicted white defendant Nathaniel Jennison by forcing him to pay additional damages to his now ex-slave, Quok Walker, who was immediately hired as a farmhand by friendly white neighbors John and Seth Caldwell. The jury interpretation stood unquestioned, and with it slavery was ended in Massachusetts for all time. It was 80 years before the Emancipation Proclamation. All who knew about the 200 or so jurors who rendered verdicts against slavery is, all we know, is that they were men and, of course, all white. Despite the courts, the jurors apparently obeyed the instructions of nature that all men are equal and free. We are all born in the same manner, have our bones clothed with the same kind of flesh, had the same breath of life breathed into us, inhabit the same common globe of earth, die in the same manner. When the Bill of Rights was adopted 8 years later, Massachusetts was still the only state free of the peculiar institution of slavery. In other northern states, there were no recorded appeals of influence, slavery being a minor issue, quote-unquote, like New Hampshire, Rhode Island, or blacks were prevented from appealing to juries, as in New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, or took their problems to court too rarely to have a lasting effect, as in Connecticut, where there were only three anti-slavery verdicts all decades apart. Powerful slaveholders in these states were able to stonewall abolitionist pressure to extend to blacks the right to appeal to juries, even though jury trials had otherwise been guaranteed since the founding of the respective colonies. When the abolitionists finally won this right for blacks in the 1840s, slavery ended in Pennsylvania and in other northern states by 1848. Which I find amazing, that juries ended slavery and not the Emancipation Proclamation. Oh, those things that my teachers never told me in school. I'm Robert Norris. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and this is Civil Rights for the Poor on Free Radio. We do 2.5 hours every Sunday from 11 to 1:30, and we're kind of winding down here. And we do 2 hours on Thursday from 6 to 8. We being me and you, or in this case, just me. And today we haven't had any callers. But I hope you've been enjoying this show. I've certainly been enjoying reading some of these selections. Well, in honor of the new harassment against Food Not Bombs, or I should say the resistance to the new harassment of Food Not Bombs up in San Francisco, let's play the following song, which is about harassment of food here in Santa Cruz. I'm pleased to say that there has been no new harassment of food servers here. apparently just harassment of activists engaging in work against police violence, because if you study the record of Steve Argue, you see what appears to be something of a pattern. Anyway, let's hear a little music.
Days in the county jail, hold my cause, hold my mail, serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. I have a shop on the street in town where hungry folks walk up and down. Some have no homes, some sick from want. So I went, got some food from a restaurant. I took it to a central spot to feed the weary, something hot. The police came, took me away. For my awful deed, I've gotta pay. With 30 days in the county jail, hold my calls, hold my mail, serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. They said I need a permit to serve free food, it must be fit. So here I am awaiting trial, while the hungry have to eat from the garbage pile. 30 days in the county jail, hold my calls, hold my mail, serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. I faced the judge and I made my plea. He looked away when he sentenced me. He said, we won't put you in that hole if you promise not to feed another living soul. I told that judge I could not say that crazy law I would obey, nor pay no fine or post no bail. Now I'm feeding folks inside the county jail. 30 days in the county jail, hold my calls, hold my mail, serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Now Ollie North, he lied under oath, lied to the judge and the Congress both. He was running drugs for the Contra War, but they locked me up because I fed the poor. Our leader George, you know he might be right when he sees 1,000 points of light with a kinder, gentler hearts like mine. But now there's just 999. 30 days in the county jail, hold my calls, hold my mail, serving soup, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. 30 days in the county jail, hold my cause, hold my mail, serving soup. That was my crime, that was my crime. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Now instead of serving soup, I'm serving time. Well, serving time.
Sure. And that was 30 Days in the County Jail with Mark Levy. Again, a song about Sandy Loringer and Marty Wormhout as city council head and mayor back in 1989 when Sandy was tried and convicted of serving free food. On the line with us now, and our first call of the day, is that man about, well, he was about the Homeless Services Center until they sent in the cops to drag him away. That's Doug McGrath. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. You've been attending the Homeless Issues Task Force or Task Force meetings, depending on how you look at it, a little of both, maybe. And you're, I guess you called me recently about the case of this guy who has spent, 90 days in jail for trespassing on the Homeless Services Center?
Yeah, precisely.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I had to make sure that he was secure in various ways, you know, not to receive more punishment, because actually what happened to him, what I'm going to tell about, was a little bit of get back, and they knew that we weren't there to protect him. They had tried to.
Actually, Doug, you had previously been, you and I guess Marilyn Weaver had previously been employees there and had provided a certain measure of protection to this man who, I guess what he was looking for, what? He was looking for shelter, and he slept on the porch of the Homeless Services Center? Is that what happened?
Exactly.
But they wouldn't put him into the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, so he said, well, I'll just sleep right here then, and they charged him with trespass, sent him to jail?
He actually thought that it was a safer way and that he wouldn't get a ticket for camping.
I see. He was afraid of the camping ban or the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance.
Precisely. You know, he doesn't do any drugs or alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And so the particular people that were preying on him that work at the shelter, didn't have anything on him that they could do. You know, I don't know if you understand. It's almost like a prison mentality. A couple of the people that work there, are like the gang thugs at a prison.
I've heard a lot of criticism of the staff under Karen Gillette as being a sort of a rather entrenched group, almost a clique that had their own rules for themselves and a completely different set of rules for others, particularly regarding drug use and a favoritism, and I had hoped that some of that was relieved under the new administration of Ken Cole. But what have you heard about that?
Well, see, everyone gets a second chance, and you know, if you keep changing directors, besides these guys have had so many chances, it's amazing already.
You're talking about the staff that are
these. There's just two people in particular. Most of the staff up there,
mm-hmm,
is really trying to do something, and are really trying to change things. These two particular people even have some of the staff, you know, kind of confused on how to act and whatever.
And
they treat people bad.
And
this gentleman...
Doug, you file complaints about these staff members yourself? Or?
We have, and this gentleman had too. In fact, he filed a formal... The last thing he told us as we were leaving is that he was going to file a formal complaint against these two people.
And then
because we had intervened a couple of times when they had called the police on him for trespassing, and the police, and we worked out something, and the supervisor Mike Bustos worked out something.
Well, what was the problem? I mean, was he in fact officially declared persona non grata on the property by the board of directors?
No, he doesn't do anything bad like that. These staff members have also invented stories about him. Actually, what they don't like is that he has an eccentricity. He doesn't like to clean up after anyone else. He'll clean up after himself.
Mm-hmm.
He's got some eccentricities,
mm-hmm,
but they're not drug or alcohol related. So they don't have any way to bribe him or for him to bribe them into acquiring a place on the church group. He doesn't like to talk to him. He doesn't like the way they talk to him, and he complains. First, what happened? he did one of these little things. He was there after we left. He didn't get on the group. He camped out on the front porch. That's all he does, is sleep on the front porch till the next morning because he feels safer. There's a light there. It's close. There's a phone. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't want to break the law camping out somewhere else.
It's actually illegal to camp there, too.
Well, he has found that out. So they called the police. They gave him a citation for trespassing, and he wouldn't sign it. You know, the old First Amendment. So he got to court, and they had to drop the charges.
Mm-hmm.
After he got out, he was still having problems with...
Did they drop the charges?
That was after 30 days. They dropped the charges and let him go.
Wait a minute. First of all, they held him in jail for 30 days.
Right. He went to court, dropped the charges.
Why did they drop the charges? Because no one would complain, or no one came to court to complain?
I really don't know that particular aspect. I would say it was because he didn't sign the ticket.
No, that wouldn't be the basis for dropping the charges. It would be if you don't have a complaining witness. But anyway, so he came back after the charges were dropped, but the charges weren't dropped until he'd spent 30 days in jail.
Right.
And then what happened?
Well, he pretty much did it again because he didn't have anywhere else to go.
So did they offer him a place in one of these ISSP groups, these church floor groups, but that are run out of the homeless services?
No, these two people took it upon themselves to not even inform. Also, I wondered where he was because he disappeared immediately after we left, and I was concerned for his safety because more people have been accosted and assaulted by staff, this type of staff, than anyone else, than any other group.
You have evidence that people have been assaulted by...
Sure, I do, and you do too. Everyone's told you. You know this.
We have to talk about
this. This is nothing that...
But anyway, when he returned after 30 days in jail, he was refused a place in the ISSP again.
Right, so he stayed on the porch. And I guess he was hoping that some supervisor would do something for him. I had asked every supervisor up there, every single one.
So what happened after his...
Where he was, other than the...
What happened after the second incident on the porch?
He went to jail, didn't sign the ticket. After 30 days, they let him out again. Charges dropped, but the judge ordered him not to go back there trespassing.
We should tell the audience that if you are being held in custody on a misdemeanor, which trespass is, you can only be held for 30 days before trial, so that's why he's being held 30 days. He hadn't been found guilty of anything, he was just being held there. Presumably he was being held, and did he want to be in jail, or would he have preferred to be out? Do we know that?
Well, everyone would probably prefer to be out. I didn't ask him that, but, you know, it was some place to sleep,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, in a safe place, so, you know, probably it was a safe place for him to sleep.
Hmm.
Anyway, this is not a criminal type
guy.
The second
time he came out, the judge said, okay, I'm giving you a court order to stay away from the homeless services center, but he went back again?
Right. So the next time he thought, well, if I go back... Also, I want to know that the first person that signed on him was not supposed to be on the property either. He was trespassing. The one that signed the deal. He was trespassing, staying in the front house against the rules and orders of the board of directors. Oh, yeah, he used to have
the one who filed the original trespass complaint against this man. Does this man want his name to be known, by the way, this fellow?
It'll be known eventually.
Okay.
No, I'll tell you him. Everyone knows who I'm talking
right,
about.
Right, I think I know his name, too.
I had to go sure that he would be safe with the proper authorities.
The third time he went back, he was violating a court order, and what happened then?
They gave him 30 days in... They let him out after 30 days and gave him a year probation.
So he's been held for a total of 90 days for three instances of sleeping on the porch.
Right.
And he is now facing a year's probation.
Right. You know, that would be like one of these automatic safe zones, I would consider. If you're afraid, where do you go? To the lighted front porch of the homeless services center.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most people don't really get it through their head for a long time as it... They just open 9 to 5, Monday through Friday type thing. It's hard to understand because homeless people are homeless 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Right.
So now he's a criminal and on probation.
Right, for the crime of sleeping.
That's right. And these two people, as far as I know, they hadn't informed Ken Cole on this. Because I had asked Ken Cole where he was.
Ken Cole, right. Ken Cole is the head of the homeless
center. Right, I talked to the health clinic. No one knew where he was. You know, there is an issue about him not showering, and he has an issue with that himself. But he He doesn't have an odor.
Well, it seems like that's
he
a
showers well. As far as I know, he's as clean as most of the staff.
That doesn't seem relevant if you're sleeping alone on a porch at night, whether you've showered or not.
I mean, to allow him on the church group.
Oh, to allow him on the church group.
Right.
I see.
And actually, I don't even really know for sure if that's true. I don't know. I just know, you know, his glasses are dirty. He has a different look. He kind of stays by himself. He's a recluse.
Well, I know the Homeless Issues Task Force is going to be, the Subcommittee on Shelter is, it's meeting on Thursday at 4:30 at the Homeless Services.
Right, we're going to talk about
that. So maybe you'll be discussing it there and we can carry on with that, because I unfortunately have, you caught me at the very end of my show.
I know, I caught you at the end of my, I had to take a break.
Any further instances of beatings or tickets that you know about?
There was, you know, I listened to the scanner. There was an instance of they sent someone to look for someone. Oh, darn. Now I've turned the page. I can't find it right now.
It's okay.
Now.
Well, listen, you can keep us advised, Doug, and hang on for just a second here. I'm going to put on a little music and to wind up to the end of the show almost, though I have a couple more announcements. I want to have a word with you, though.
Okay.
Don't go away.
They say that the tree of loving will shine on me again. They say it grows on the bank of the river of suffering, will shine on me again. Yeah.
We need sunshine out of the pouring rain. We need hope of a new tomorrow. Fill my cup again.
Show is over. Little Red Hen's not going to be in today, but she has given me some loop tapes to play, so I'm going to make a few quick announcements and then hit the road. Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz will be available if you give them a call at 426-0644. That's the way to make your life easier. If the landlord's breathing down your back, at least you'll know what you're facing. Rent Stabilization Initiative folks meet every Saturday at 3 o'clock at the Java House. Check them out. Of course, I've already mentioned to you, if you want to get involved with the Hate-Free Zone Initiative, David Silva on Thursdays at noon is at the City Council Fountain. You can find him there. 10 a.m., an important trial on October 22nd starts. That's a couple weeks down the road. On Department 6, that's Dennis Reams' arguments around the Feige defense of failure to pay on camping tickets. We've talked about that on the air a bit. It's a very, very important case. He's gotten an attorney, and he's arguing that since a camping ticket or even a sleeping ticket, of whether it's sleeping or camping, is an infraction, and these infractions are not subject to jail. Therefore, failures to pay cannot be subject to jail. And that's going to be an argument that he's going to make and may well win from what we hear could be very significant for other people facing sleeping tickets. If you cannot be forced to pay, then you are a step down the road to making the law already quite pointless, at least fangless as well as pointless. As I've already mentioned, Nassim Zarifi's jury trial begins 9 a.m. October 18th in Department 2. That's next Monday. Mark that note on your calendar. Is that next Monday or is that Monday after next? See, today... No, that is next Monday. A week from tomorrow, I should say. There's a very important solidarity training coming up. It's some people call it a nonviolence training, but it's more than that. It's about jailhouse solidarity. It's about how to deal with police when they come at you with pain compliance holds. It's about how to know your rights when police are approaching you. It's being done by the attorney activist Katya Komisarek, and it'll be at the Loudon Nelson Center October 28th, noon to 7. For more information, contact the Rise Zone at 224 Walnut, and the Rise Zone phone number, for those who don't already have it, is 423-8223. There's a homeless congress coming up in San Francisco. We're going to talk more about that. That's at the end of the month. And, of course, there's a crisis coming up at the end of the year for 20 HIV families, HIV households, that are being cut off tenant-based rental assistance. So that's not just 20 people. That's 20 families, and 60 other families are due to get evicted after that. We're going to have to talk more about that, and we will. But I'm afraid now my talking time is over. Thank you for being with me on Bathrobe Spears Broadside. Stay tuned for recorded stuff from the Little Red Hen and other loop tapes here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I will be returning to you. Well, you'll see me at the protest on Tuesday at 2. I hope to see you there with your vehicle and your mattress and your sleeping bag. Who knows, maybe a thermos of coffee. Tomorrow I'll be at the Citizens Police Review Board meeting at 5:30 down at City Hall, in case you want to come to that. Hey, and if you get bored in between and you want to do some work around homeless civil rights, give a call to 423-HUFF. Thanks for being with me, and join me again Thursday at 6 o'clock on Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. I'll be joining you then. Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're waiting for these loop tapes to engage.